The C Word is an Odyssey podcast.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A hot mess.
Desperate.
Monster.
What an abortion.
The biggest liar I have ever come across.
Miserable, pitiful, incoherent, and shameful.
Steroid juicing masculine freak.
Dude looks like a lady.
Is that a woman?
She might look like a man, but she lies like a woman. This week, we're talking about China.
You wanna know if I'll survive, get along okay without you. I'll be fine, yeah, I'll be alright. No, that's a lie, I will fucking die, don't break up.
Welcome back to The C Word, a Luminary Podcast production. This is a show where we discuss women whose society deemed mad, sad, or just plain bad. We attempt to untangle who they really were beyond their wild reputations.
We are going to talk about women who've been called crazy by sifting through the cultural trash heap of history, one rumor at a time.
I am the biggest liar I have ever come across, Lena Dunham.
And I am Alyssa Bennett, historian of bad behavior.
And we will never call you crazy. Before we get started, we don't claim to know all the facts, folks. We're just very passionate students of these women in history, and we're trying to focus a lens, what is it? A lens of the feminist gaze on how and why these women...
A wide-angle lens.
A wide-angle lens so we can fit my whole ass on how and why these women achieve notoriety.
This is a discussion about what various people have said about these women over the years, and we are not saying that every statement or account we will be discussing is necessarily true. So if you hear something that interests you, go do your own investigation. You'll love it.
Our hearts are in the right place, and together we can try and get to the bottom of what has been said about these women over time. Now, on to China.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Monday Night.
Former WWE star and trailblazer Chyna.
Former wrestling star Chyna.
Chyna doll.
Noted for her physical size and strength, Lara earned the nickname the ninth wonder of the world.
It's transformative in the world of wrestling.
I've wrestled men, I've wrestled women, and I beat them all.
Before her, women just were kind of a sideline in this whole business, and she changed everything.
She used to be China on the WWF, and then Vince, you know, kicked her out and said, you can't use the name anymore.
Can't use the name. Can't, we own everything.
We own you.
Please leave.
I mean, she did a sex tape.
El Desperado.
Who's the man?
She went into porn. You remember that?
I do remember that.
Yeah.
As She-Hulk Triple X.
Struggled with a lot of addiction issues.
I'm tired. I'm China. I'm a tan man.
Alyssa, what are five things we need to know about China?
Number one, China was known as an iconic wrestler, bodybuilder, and later as a porn star. She rose to fame with the WWF, which is now the WWE, and she was one of the first women wrestlers who could physically rival men. It was a really big deal. She was an absolute game changer. Number two, but China had some demons, and they took center
stage.
Don't we all? China had some demons and they took center stage after she was dropped by the WWE, despite being a major name for the franchise. Even I knew who she was. Like, she was like a major cultural figure, a huge breakthrough star. You know, we knew her as a wrestler before we knew her for the bad behavior. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Oh, yeah. She was hugely famous. And like as a teenager, I knew who she was the same way I knew who like Carmen Electra was.
Right, right. So Chyna began struggling with an addiction to meth. Eventually, she was estranged now not just from her biological family, but from her former WWE family as well, which became like a major injury to her identity. We're going to get into it.
Yeah.
Number three, by this point, she was still considered a wrestling icon and had also become kind of a sex symbol. And after a sex tape was released without her permission, she decided to move into an industry that would support her better than the WWE did. The adult entertainment industry, we know they're a very supportive people.
We know that they really value the mental and physical health of their constituents.
Take care of their own. So this is very complicated. We're going to delve very deeply into this, so don't worry, we're going to get there.
And something I love about this episode is how we're able to kind of find the cross-section of so many of our interests, which are reality TV, the adult entertainment industry, and these sort of intense cultural moments that may have been forgotten to sort of like the tweens of today, but will never be forgotten by us.
Yeah,
and
this is a really complex episode.
And she sits at this kind of center of the Venn diagram of all of these different moments. And also at these really interesting questions about femininity, masculinity, the way that her body was fetishized, but being attracted to her was sort of considered a freaky fetish. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. Number four. So her addiction ramped up. She was becoming more isolated than ever by the late 2000s. And she tried to start fresh by wrestling in Japan, and that kind of worked for a little bit. But eventually she returned to America, where a crew filmed her as she tried to attempt a comeback. Number five, Chyna was found dead on April 20th, 2016. She was 46 years old. Okay, so just a disclaimer at the top of this episode. You know, often when we write about these women, there will be one piece of journalism or one documentary that is like the most complete in existence. So there is one document like this. It's by Jason King. It's called The Great Fall of Chyna. It's amazing. Go read it. It's a very incredible piece of sports journalism about her end of days. And I really would like to acknowledge it and to acknowledge King because he did an incredible job. And there's a lot of information from people in her life that we wouldn't have without this piece of writing.
And I'd like to acknowledge Alyssa Bennett for her incredibly close watch of Celebrity Rehab.
I mean, how many times have I watched Celebrity Rehab? It's an illness.
As many times as I've watched the Lindsay Lohan Oprah Winfrey Rehab show.
I've never seen it.
It's when she gets out of rehab and Oprah helps her stage a comeback, but she literally won't get out of bed, and it's a true piece of art.
Okay, I'm going to watch it. You know, when I was a teenager, me and Pokey Peitch made a deal that we were going to save anal sex until we were older, so we had something to look forward to, and maybe I saved this Lindsay Lohan documentary.
That's in the so same way. Cute. And also the idea that you would think anal sex was something to look forward to.
I know.
That's the most demented part. It's like the minute you try anal sex, you're like, that was certainly not something to look forward to.
I know. For listeners who don't know, Pokey Peitch is like my best friend from seventh grade. And we met because I said I liked her shoes, and then a maxi pad that I didn't need fell out of my backpack and landed on them.
Love. But okay, so in the beginning, Chyna was born Joan Marie Lohrer. It was December 27th, 1969, in Rochester, New York. If you've ever been to Rochester, New York, you'll know there is a permacloud over that place. It's not the coziest.
It's cold.
I'm sure there's a lot of amazing people in Rochester, but, you know, my dad went to college there and people called it Crochester.
All of our three upstate subscribers have just canceled.
Canceled. They're like, you piece of trash. But I will say Ithaca is gorgeous.
Yeah, good one.
Thank you. She was the third child to parents Janet and Joe. As a kid, she was called Joni. So until she officially became Chyna, we're going to refer to her in this episode as Joni. Talk to me about how things were at home, Alyssa.
You know what? They were not great. Her dad was an alcoholic who was frequently out of work and had a volatile relationship with Joni's mom. And her mom later claimed that Joni witnessed him stab her with a butcher knife, I believe, over a spaghetti dinner.
Jesus F. Joni would later say that her father would sometimes get so drunk that he would bring women back to the family home because he forgot that he lived with a wife and three kids. The couple divorced when Joni was four.
I mean, that's real. If that happened, that's real.
Yeah.
But also, I think just to bookend this, before we get too deep into Joni's childhood, it's very important to note right here that many of her interviews and statements eventually become incredibly contradictory. So it becomes a really significant part of the story of her life, and it's going to happen well into her adulthood. She seemed to constantly be trying to control the public's perception of who she was, and her impulsivity led her to make claims that were kind of customized to suit whatever situation she was in at any given moment.
For example, though she had published a New York Times bestseller that offered a very grim and detailed account of this kind of rough Scrabble girlhood just 4 years before, China suggested she'd had a very different kind of upbringing in a shambolic 2005 interview with one Wendy Williams.
Wait, can I say something about this interview, though? It's so shambolic that you watch it and you think this is fucking actionable. Like, it seems immoral that this was broadcast and that a person like me can still access it today.
Can we watch this clip and respond to it, please?
Ooh, yes.
Did you grow up with money?
I was born into money.
What kind of money?
I had the money.
No. Listen to me. When you were being raised, was your dad making $150,000, $200,000 a year? Or was money, $800,000? I mean,
my daddy was bringing home Colombian diamonds.
Okay.
She literally says that she didn't come out of her own mother's womb.
The more incredible thing about this interview to me is that I'm hard-pressed to imagine a situation in which I would be so disillusioned by life and so jaded by, like, celebrity in Hollywood that I would conduct this interview, not think there's something really wrong, this woman needs help, and then proceed to put it out in the public.
Well, what we've learned about Wendy Williams, who is a complex figure herself and could be her own episode of the C word, TBH.
But you know, the interesting thing about this, what this brings up for me is that you and I recently had a conversation about what sort of cultural service reality television performs. And I think one of those services is that it allows people that are watching it to think, thank God that's not me. And Wendy Williams, I think in some way, is kind of doing the same thing because she can posit herself in contrast to someone who's much more fucked up than she is. And kind of, you know, it defines both characters for her.
Well, I have to say that, like, when I was, I would say, at my worst moment, looking at the Daily Mail and seeing, like, you know, someone dumping their baby out of their stroller became a source of comfort for me. And when I went to treatment, the first thing I watched when I got there wasn't like Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. It was every episode of the Lindsay Lohan Oprah show where Lindsay's just gotten out of rehab, because there was like a comfort in imagining that, like, my circumstances hadn't hit that level.
Well, but it's reality television is a reflective surface. And I think that we see Wendy Williams using China as a reflective surface in this clip.
Beautifully, beautifully said.
So Joni is 4 years old. Her parents' divorce didn't make things better, and Joni and her siblings were being shuffled from house to house with their mother and a string of stepfathers, which we know usually doesn't go that well. So Joni would later characterize her mother as remote, cold, and frighteningly temperamental. She suggested in her autobiography that her mother's supposed dissatisfaction often manifested in yelling and this very kind of harsh form of disciplinarianism, and that it left her feeling a combination of anxiety and shame, which I think we see her carrying throughout the rest of her life. I relate to this really deeply. I am kind of a secretive person in a lot of ways. And it's going to come up later when we start to discuss her flexible relationship with reality and her continued denials that she had a drug problem.
Yeah, and I'm not a secretive person. And I sort of like live with the sense that I've already told people everything and I've got to really continue to be honest because, like, the details of my story could emerge at any time. And I always find it really fascinating when people think that they can control the world around them and can control the message in this way. But we do need to note that Joni's mother would later deny much of what was published in the autobiography, though she is open about having been estranged from Joni. We don't know. We weren't there. Both these women seem to have been holding not a lot of space for each other, to use the parlance of our times.
We weren't there. So things weren't really that much better outside of the home either. Joni was sort of a big kid with a very severe underbite. And you know what? Kids are dickheads, so they teased her. So her dad was off doing whatever he was doing. Her mom seemed kind of chronically dissatisfied, and they moved all the time, so she never had a chance to kind of solidify any friendships. So guess what? She was depressed, and it was lonely.
So, like 90% of all C-word subjects, Joni grew up obsessed with finding a future in the public eye because in her fantasies, fame probably sounded like a decent surrogate for an attentive parent. Guess what, Joni? I'll tell you, it's not. I had a nice parent. It is. I had really attentive parents, but I thought that fame could potentially be a surrogate for friends. Nope.
I mean, I think that if you grow up with this deep longing to be regarded by someone and suddenly you can be regarded by the world, it's incredibly narcotic. And there's a quote from her that I find sad. And it's in a documentary that was made when she was like at the height of her power. And she said, quote, "Everybody wants to be somebody big or something spectacular. Every little kid wants to be a movie star or a basketball player, you know, somebody rich and famous." So this is a person who grew up thinking that the only life that had like true validity was one that was lived in the public eye.
And she wanted to be seen and remembered.
Hey there, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and your money is going to move. We're going to help you make better financial decisions. We're going to call out the BS you're finding all over social media. We're going to give you actionable guidance to make your financial life clearer, less stressful. We're going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen to Money Moves with Jill Schlesinger wherever you get your podcasts.
By seventh grade, she's lonely, she's awkward, she's looking for attention, and she's doing her best to overachieve. This girl plays the cello. She does well in school. She wants to be a good girl, as my therapist said to me. Where's that gotten you? And she was probably psyched.
When were you a good girl?
I was
from like first
really great
to
question.
Second grade?
No, not even then. So she's trying to be a good girl. And she was probably psyched when a teacher noticed she was lonesome and started spending some time with her after class.
Like classic predatory behavior. So according to her autobiography,
I had one of these teachers.
Oh yeah, I remember you telling me about it. So according to her autobiography, the thrill was gone after he kissed her one afternoon and said, "I've only fallen in love with one of my students before you." She was 13.
It's not nice. God. So she's 13 onward. Over the next couple of years, Joni became obsessed with Jane Fonda workout videos because they took her mind off her problems. By 15, she was a consummate loser at school. So she started going to the gym where she did sit-ups and push-ups and rode an exercise bike every day until they turned the lights out.
So according to her autobiography, this is also around the time that she started binging and purging. There has been some research that indicates relationship between bodybuilding and disordered eating. You know, we don't want to pathologize bodybuilding by any means, particularly when our society already demonizes women who choose to pursue a physical appearance outside of the very narrow beauty standards that we live within. But it's important to recognize that for China, these experiences may have been intertwined, and it's her individual psyche that we're focusing. So we're not talking about all of you bitches. Fucking respect. I'm obsessed with you. Go build your bodies. It's more dedication than I've ever had for anything. But in terms of China, she's focusing on the things in her life that she could control in like an out of control system. And her body was one of them.
So the changes she observed in her body and in her strength made her feel both powerful and seen. And in classic addict style, she goes all out. So this is a quote. "Why stop? I felt ugly anyway. I didn't have a whole lot of friends. So what did it matter? It wasn't going to make it any better if I stopped. At least in that little gym world, there were people who were starting to notice. I liked the looks I got. Guys in the gym would see me lifting this ungodly amount of weight. Or maybe they were just looking at my body and I liked that. The more I lifted, the more people would look at me. You could just tell what they were thinking. Oh my God, she's so big, so strong."
So there's, I think, something to remember about bodybuilding, and particularly in female bodybuilders, is that there is like this very narrow slice of the population that has the genetic propensity to get as big as she did naturally. It's very rare. It's like a thing that you either kind of have or you don't. You know, people had never seen anyone like her. She was really big, very strong. And as she started to get bigger and stronger, her body started to make people feel uncomfortable. They would call her a man. They would call her a beast. They would call her a lesbian. And later she said she felt, quote, rejected and extremely unaccepted. So I think also something that's important is a lot of these quotes that we're using now come from moments when she still had some power. She was kind of at the peak of her power. And so she's putting all of these things out into the world and people aren't picking them up. She's saying, like, I feel like I've been, my identity has been constructed based on how people are alarmed by my appearance, and we remain alarmed by the appearance, despite her, you know, I think very frankly saying, I need to be accepted.
So meanwhile, Joni's still really not getting along with her mom. So when Joni's 16, her mom supposedly accuses her of smoking weed and tries to take her to rehab. As we all know, you don't need to go to rehab if you've smoked weed a couple of times. The resulting altercation leads to Joni being like, bye, bye. Joni moves in with, guess who? Her dad.
Daddy.
She'd later describe him as a kind of Baron von Munchausen grifter type who she claimed would lie about being involved in top secret government work or international banking. She said he was unstable and unreliable, but also that he encouraged her and she adored him. Once again, we also need to note that he claimed she had mischaracterized him in her book and he had no idea why she was lying. As usual, we don't know. We weren't there. All I know is my daddy was bringing home Colombian diamonds.
So Joni continued working out like her life depended on it, because it probably in some ways did, because it was the only way that she could kind of find purchase in the world. She finished out her senior year of high school in Spain, and by the time she graduated, her father decided for her that she should join the military. So he picked her college, University at Tampa. He told her she needed to join the ROTC, which I never knew what this stood for, but it's Reserve Officers Training Corps. Can you imagine? Onward. I'm just going to leave that there. God bless our military, by the way. So on a darker note, she did write in her autobiography that while at school, she was raped by two football players at a party.
In her Wrestling Observer newsletter, Obit, it is noted that she walked these claims back in her lifetime, and some have said she later admitted that they weren't true. We will probably never know what happened here, but we do know that China would make various public claims about sexual trauma, whether it was her middle school teacher or future boyfriend, throughout her life. This is a woman who probably never felt truly safe around men.
In 1991, she graduates and decides, at her grifter dad's urging, to join the Peace Corps. She headed to Costa Rica, but it proved to be unsatisfying because she was totally traumatized by life and had, quote, things to do. I got things to do.
So once she was back in incredible stately Florida, she tried to figure out what she wanted to do in between reps at the gym where she was getting swole.
And she was drifting a little bit at this point. She had a chain of jobs doing things like, can you imagine? This is like a dream of mine now. She delivered singing telegrams. Love it. Do they still have those? Love it.
I actually thought about trying to send a singing telegram to someone last week. Then I was like, that seems like a lot of work.
Oh, I love it. She bartended in a kind of counterfeit Florida Hooters.
So it's like basically it was called like Booters or something. Yeah. It was like just an off-brand Hooters.
Yeah. She jerked people off with her words as a 900 number operator.
Oh, so impressive.
And she tried to find some joy in life in flight attendant school. All the while, she kept training because it was the one place in her life where she, like we said earlier, had absolute control.
So finally, she moved in with her sister Kathy in New Hampshire, joined a health club, became the star saleswoman at a beeper shop. For those who are too young to remember, a beeper is like a phone you can't talk into that goes around your waist, and started doing it with her personal trainer. Fun! She and her personal trainer slash boyfriend went to the gym at 4:30 in the morning 5 days a week, where she bench pressed 315 pounds, boxed, and weight trained. At night, she walked on a Stairmaster wearing 80 pounds of weights in a backpack. This girl got fucking huge.
She got fucking huge. So at this point, she starts competing in fitness modeling competitions, but she never won any of them because her body type for this time and this sort of competition was considered too developed.
So at this point, she was considered too big to do the job.
She was too big to do the job. And I want to offer some context now that I'm a specialist. So women's bodybuilding started in the late 1970s. And by the late 80s, the ideal was basically like a very toned bikini body. And there was a lot of sexism in the sport, as we can imagine, that aimed to, quote, this is a quote, keep women looking like women. So, you know, I went down this female bodybuilder documentary, YouTube Vortex. There are some really amazing ones. Like, if you've never seen Pumping Iron 2, the women, go fucking watch it. It's out of control good. And the absolute dedication required to pursue this life is really exhausting. Like, if you watch a documentary about how a female bodybuilder preps for competition, it's insane.
I literally can't even imagine.
So women also got into it knowing that people were going to be repulsed by them, which makes this strange loop where the object of the dedication, which is the body, also becomes the object of scorn. So the world of competitive female bodybuilding is extremely, extremely subcultural, which is why I like it. And it's also part of why China's fame is such an anomaly and why her role as a public figure became so important for so many different kinds of women.
Alyssa, I love you on this topic.
Thank you so much.
So Joni, who did not fit in anywhere and had focused her attention on developing a body that did not adhere to the traditional standards of sexiness, sees a men's wrestling match on TV one night and says, I could do that.
So she started to go see these matches live. And by 1995, she found her way to a Massachusetts training school known for churning out new WWF stars. It was run by this guy, Killer Klizowski. There had certainly been women involved in pro wrestling before, but they were typically either playing valets, which were like the hot women who seconded male wrestlers and sort of were instrumentalized to develop plot lines, like the hot girlfriend or the girl that walks the guy out to the wrestling match. Or they were novelty performers like the Fabulous Moolah, who were much more limited to kind of slapping and hair pulling.
Joni's physique put her physically more on par with male wrestlers. She was big, she was strong, and she found that she was able to do things like pick up other trainees, body slam them, and then take a hard body slam in return.
Like you. Later in 1995, she...
Just, you know, girls at camp used to play a game where they would throw me down on the ground and then time how long it took me to get up.
Ay, bendito. So later, and it took 24 years... Later in 1995, she makes her debut as Joni Lee in a match against a performer named Raindrops, who a man dressed as a woman.
Let's break this down. She was physically powerful in a way that made people not know what to do with her. So their solution is not to let her have a match against a cis-presenting man and to turn up all of this gender confusion about who she was. It's also going to come up later that a lot of people thought that men would be shamed if they lost to a woman. So all of the insults she faced about her gender and sexuality come into play here.
So wrestler Joni Lee hits the regional circuit, and in 1996, she meets two WWF wrestlers named Paul Triple H Levesque and Shawn Michaels, who are impressed by her power and her stamina, and they decide that they're going to bring her into their act.
Watch this space.
Watch this space. So Triple H and Shawn approached WWF owner Vince McMahon about bringing Joni in, and they suggested that she could come on in the role of a bodyguard. So once again, just to provide some cultural context, some specialized cultural context, at this time, which was in the late 90s, wrestling was becoming a major corporate business in a way that it hadn't been before. And it was in large part due to the machinations of Vince McMahon. And Triple H and Shawn Michaels were also founding members of D-Generation X, which was one of the major wrestling teams in the business. They were both incredibly visible in this world at this time. And these three men, Vince, Triple H, and Shawn, are going to feature very heavily in the drama that typifies the remainder of China's life.
Yeah, these guys kind of bring a certain level of chaos that becomes extremely, extremely essential to the way that she's moving.
The other thing that they do is that they kind of instrumentalize her in a way that makes her feel important, but then in a way that's in the future going to become like incredibly corrosive, because she starts to base her whole identity around this relationship, and the relationship doesn't last.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
And the relationship spoiler, and there's going to be some, you know, woman-on-woman catfight drama that really hurts China's business and emotions.
Meow,
but
back
to the moment. So this idea of her playing a role as a bodyguard deviated significantly from the traditionally feminine role of valet because it implied that Joni would be the muscle of the operation and get in on physical action if need be. She's protecting them.
She's protecting them. And Vince McMahon, first, when this idea was first presented to him, he allegedly did not think that audiences would find it believable to see a woman beating up men. So regardless of the fact that she is kind of physically equipped with the power to get into this ring and wrestle in the same way that these male colleagues can wrestle, Vince McMahon is like, no one's going to believe this shit. It's not believable.
And China and Triple H have also said he couldn't imagine that a male wrestler would consent to potentially losing to a girl because everyone knows that is too humiliating for contemplation. We can't take it.
Right. Like, men don't even want to lose checkers to a woman. So imagine like a physical fight in a ring. So, you know, I think something that we have to kind of touch on is that the entire pleasure for people when they are watching wrestling is that the performances are incredibly baroque. And they're all kind of oriented around these notions of good versus evil and these kind of deep-seated ideologies of what justice means. So if China was put into the ring with someone who couldn't engage in the performance with her, the whole thing falls apart. The bottom falls out of it, and nobody believes anything. Yeah,
there needs to be a lot of performance consent involved in this entire thing. And so a man resisting the role he's being given is going to take away like this illusion. And even though wrestling is full of bad acting and ham-fisted plot lines, still everybody is making the choice to believe together. It's like Disney World.
Right, right.
So eventually McMahon was convinced and Joni made a nameless debut in 1997, initially presented as an audience member who rushed to the ring to assault a delicate-looking woman valet in a LeMay mini dress. Joni was acknowledged on air when an announcer said, quote, who the hell is that? Is that a woman?
Make it in there. How is she wood? Get him, Hunter.
Who the hell's that? Who is that?
What in the world?
Is that a woman?
Okay, so we have, I think his name is Gold Dust, the wrestler that wears all gold and like gold face paint, and his valet is named Marlena. And they're in the ring against, I don't know, Triple H or Shawn Michaels. I don't know who it is, but because the only thing you notice is China. So China comes in and it's this charade that she's just an audience member. So she shows up. One of the announcers is like, is that a woman? She's very
big.
Which
she clearly is a woman. But yes. So it's like they're just being rudelings.
Yes, they're just being rude. But the difference physically in her body and in Marlena's body, and remember that Marlena is like the physical type that everyone would have seen in terms of what femininity looked like in wrestling from its inception, basically. So the difference in their physical bodies, their builds, is so overwhelming to look at.
Yeah. So that is a huge part of her career at the beginning, this idea of, is that a woman?
Right.
And also the idea that that is an insult, because like, I remember when it occurred to me that certain insults that were sort of popular, somebody telling you that you're, like, for me, it was always people commenting on my weight in high school. But for other people I know, it was people commenting on their gender presentation. And the idea that, like, you kind of zoom back powers of 10 style and go, like, wait, what you're saying actually isn't an insult. Like, what you're saying, like, these questions about gender or these questions about body type, actually, when looked at through another lens, like, you can't touch me with that because it's not a real insult. But she was living at a moment where, is that a woman, was a very real insult.
Oh, it's so painful.
Like, the chill down your body of being like, what I saw when I looked in the mirror was this, like, delicate pixie of a woman, and what you're seeing is...
Well, it like, goes to the core of your identity. And I think that the fact that this was so built into sort of the corporatization of China as a character within wrestling, and that it was such a recurrent flashpoint for people to talk about from the beginning, we have to kind of imagine what that meant to her. Even if she's in on it, like, even if she understands that she, like, her power is sort of gender twisting, it would be fucking hard. It would be really fucking hard.
So by 1998, Joanie had joined Triple H and X-Pac as a full-time member of their crew. She was given the name China because WWF Brass thought it was very LOL to name this gigantic woman after something so fragile. Also, and this is what I was hinting at before, she was secretly doing it with Triple H by now. And this will come up later.
Guess what? It's going to come up later.
And isn't it fun to imagine
all over your face.
All over your face. And isn't it fun to imagine that when they first started doing it, these two giant, terrifying wrestlers would be like really delicately touching each other and looking into each other's eyes?
You know, I didn't get there, Lena, but maybe.
I just like naming her China in an act of irony.
Maybe.
I like the idea that they're like the calmest of lovemakers. I don't think it's necessarily true.
You know what the truth is? Even though China is breaking molds, she's shattering the proverbial glass ceiling, regardless of the fact that she was fighting men and gaining more and more professional traction. She was a young woman and was incredibly devastated whenever anyone was like, I hear China has a penis, or the steroids sure have done a number on that man's face. So these are like both the internal commentary that is written into these plot lines, and it's coming from the fans. It's coming from everywhere. So people are really exaggerating their shock at like what they're terming to be like her indeterminate gender. No one wants this. So she, at this point, undergoes her first cosmetic procedures. She got breast implants, she got a nose job, and then she had very, very major surgery to reset her jaw. And, you know, while I was researching China, I also came across this bodybuilder, Joanna Thomas, who said women bodybuilders have to, quote, exaggerate the rest of their femininity to compensate for what society states as being masculine. So she's in this mode of compensation.
Also, when China's first set of implants ruptured in the ring, she went back to the surgical drawing board. A new type of implant was designed to fit her body. What a kind of, I don't know, privilege.
Permanent impact.
This model became known as the China 2000 by plastic surgeons and is still marketed to female bodybuilders today.
Work.
That's wild detail. So China was suddenly famous and powerful. She's becoming a sex symbol. Men were obsessed with her. She was on MTV giving interviews all the time, which is how I came across China. People wanted her autograph. This was a huge turnaround from her earlier life. Let's process what this must have felt like.
Can we process? So when you watch these interviews, and all of you can because they're on YouTube, you can immediately feel that she like suddenly has this sense that she actually belongs somewhere. So she discusses how the male wrestlers that she was working with at the time gave her the nickname the ninth wonder of the world, because Andre the Giant was the eighth wonder of the world. And you just sense this kind of immediate pride that she felt not only to be accepted by these men, but also to finally feel sexually desired after a lifetime of feeling unattractive, unwanted, and most importantly, not at home. Like, she's not at home in the actual domestic home. She's not at home in her body. You know, this restructuring of the truth is like to try to implement a home within the narrative of her life, and the restructuring of her body is trying to feel at home in her body. It's a very complicated, very sad story.
So in 1999, she was the first female wrestler to enter the WWF's Royal Rumble. That year, she also became the first woman to wrestle in the Intercontinental Championship match, which she won. Her winning match against Jeff Jarrett was Good Housekeeping themed. Good Housekeeping was like a magazine.
I think it still is. I should probably read it because I'm not a good housekeeper. Lena today asked to see a picture of my bedroom and I had to say absolutely not because it's
she was like
a disaster.
She was like, that's just not going to happen.
No.
She was just like, it's not going to happen. This Good Housekeeping themed image is wild and she's pieing him in the face with like a huge industrial whipped cream pie. There's also an image in which someone on a wrestling website put China looking sad in a cage next to a dog and said, Jeff Jarrett saved China from SPCA 1 hour before euthanization.
It's so fucked up. It's just wrestling fans, get your act together.
Like, be nice.
Jesus. Actually, you know what? Some of you are all right, but some of you are real free on the comments boards and you should, you know, think about if someone talked about your mother like that. So the main thing here that we cannot stress enough is what kind of feminist contributions China made, not only in wrestling, but in general, in the world of real things. She was an absolute pioneer. She was a huge inspiration to legions of girls and proof that a woman could be considered among the best in a male-driven sport. Like, imagine if some 7-foot-tall goddess joined, like, the NFL. It's that earth-shattering. So her signature move was literally punching guys in their dicks. But we don't remember any of these things about her. And I want to know why we're so focused on the downfall. And I'm guilty of this without even knowing what she was falling from. Like, I think culturally, because she became such a flashpoint for failure and for, like, self-immolation, we look at that and we don't look at how she became a public figure. And this is part of what's so fascinating and incredible about this story.
So by 2000, China was a new kind of sex symbol for the WWF, and it maybe is not a huge surprise that a Playboy came calling. They love a flashy new opportunity. They love a young Kim Kardashian.
Would you do Playboy?
I was in Playboy clothed, and so I have this cool t-shirt that says, I posed today with a Playboy bunny. But my thing was always, like, I've been naked so much in my work. I feel like what's special about Playboy is, or was special about Playboy, is, like, getting to see the body of someone who had kept their body in someone right. under lock.
Right.
And it's like, if everyone already knows what your body looks right. like, then it's kind of just a cheesier version of being naked. And there were moments, like, who shocked everyone by doing Playboy and kind of ruined her career? It was somewhat...
Vanessa Williams really fucked her up.
It really fucked her career up. It really fucked up. Like, people were very judgy about Drew Barrymore doing it, even though her pictures were so cool. Like, actresses who did Playboy got a certain kind of backlash.
Yeah, absolutely. So
now Playboy's, like, doing, like, pretty 1970s photos by Petra Collins.
So China does Playboy. She's on the cover. She has a pictorial. And also, I think, like, just for one moment, imagine what this feels like to this person who literally made her debut in the WWF with people saying, is that a woman? Right?
Yeah,
like,
100%.
She goes and does the shoot, and she's like, finally, like, somebody is going to recognize that I'm hot, that I have worked so hard on my body, and that I deserve this.
Yeah. And by the way, like, her body literally looks like X-Men drawings.
She's like it's fucking Xena, you know? It's, and if I remember correctly, her career and Xena kind of intersect. So there's this new moment of, you know, this fetish that develops around a physically powerful woman. And she's right at the center of it.
And she also has, when you hear her voice, it's oddly like Marilyn Monroe squeaky. So when it comes out of her body, there's just a lot of sort of complexity around the way she presents herself.
I think that she caused a lot of gender confusion. And I think that, you know, doing this pictorial was a moment for her to say, I'm not just an object of fascination for, like, a fetishist community. I can be an object of desire for the community at large.
100%.
So we have to know that there's probably some part of her motivation related to her desire to lay to rest any suspicion that she wasn't biologically female. She said over and over that the experience was one that finally made her feel celebrated for being strong, feminine, and beautiful.
Supposedly, McMahon didn't want her to do it and said she wouldn't win a championship if she did. We don't know. We weren't there. And in early 2001, China's autobiography, If Only They Knew, was published. It hits the New York Times bestseller list in February, and everything is looking up for our girl.
She's like, imagine me, like an ugly girl from Rochester. She grew up feeling like an ugly girl from Rochester that nobody cared about, who was unwanted. She didn't have friends. And suddenly she's like in Playboy and she has a New York Times bestselling book. It's fucking major.
She's really doing it. She's having her moment. Meanwhile, who has China been dating, Alyssa?
Triple H.
She loves him. She loves him. They live together. But she starts to notice that something is a bit off.
So she eventually discovered that Triple H was having an affair with Stephanie McMahon, who was the daughter of Vince McMahon. Remember, the owner of the WWF and basically the owner of China's whole career at this point in her life. This story is like a gossip bacchanal. It is, oh, there's, it's like incredible. A twist at every turn. A twist
because
at every
you know
turn.
How China says she found out about this affair?
Tell me, bitch.
By picking a lock on Triple H's briefcase and finding a love letter. Hot. Like, who wrote this? The WWF?
Oh, it's so
According
good.
To her account, this came after many months of him supposedly gaslighting her and calling her she was crazy when she asked him if he had something going on the side. Classico.
You know what? If you're ever like, are you having an affair and your partner is like, you're fucking crazy, pack your bags because they are.
Honestly, fully. Truly. Like, if you say, are you having an affair Truly. And your partner's like, why do you feel that way? Of course I'm not. You can stay. If they say you're fucking nuts
and get mad
guess
at
what
you,
they're doing.
Guess what? You're right. Your psychic
Oh my God.
Sense is
and
correct.
Also, if they say something to you like, no, but I should be based on how you're acting because I'd
they're
get
already
the same treatment.
Like, you've just given them an excuse to like not
yeah,
feel
they're
bad
already doing
that they're
it.
Having
if
an
they
affair.
Weren't doing it, they're doing it. Now they're like,
so
God,
wise.
She's so mean to me.
We're so wise.
We're
yeah.
so wise.
They're like,
come to us and help us.
Truth. So we don't know if this is actually how it went down. I wasn't there. I'm just guessing. But clearly this breakup was like absolutely crushing. These are all public people. So China would have started to see these two as a couple appearing in magazines, you know, in trade papers. She would have had to face it. And I remember seeing photographs of a person whom I will not name, who I was in a kind of indeterminate relationship with in art world gossip pages with the woman he was having an affair with. You literally just feel like you have floated away into the ether like a decaying plastic bag. It is so horrible. It sucks.
That's so hideous.
Oh, it's horrible. Horrible. Both of us know what it's like to see your ex going out with someone and they're like in the fucking Daily Mail every single day of your
oh
life.
Oh my God.
You feel like I can never get away from you. And that's what's happening
here. I can
here.
Never get away from you. And like, you feel like you shouldn't be having any response because you're not in a relationship with them anymore.
Yes. It's like filthy voyeurism.
I know.
You look at it and it feels not only like I can never get away from you, but it feels like you're invading their privacy and it will never end.
It's brutal. It's just all of it's brutal.
It's brutal.
And so basically, if you're China and you're looking at Stephanie McMahon and Triple H, bang it out, you're not going to be having a good time.
Also, remember that she's the boss's daughter. So it's a very uncomfortable position. So she's upset because being cheated on sucks. Believing you're being cheated on sucks. And then shit gets worse because shortly thereafter, in November of 2001, she is fired from the WWF.
Talk to me about this. Why?
So she says that when she was informed of her termination, she was eating a sandwich in Jerry's Deli in LA, and a fax literally came through in the deli for her that was like, we regret to inform you, ... Sincerely, Vince McMahon. So we don't know exactly why her contract was terminated. There are some theories. It might have been because she posed for Playboy against McMahon's wishes. McMahon denies this. It might have been based on the fallout of Triple H's affair with the daughter of McMahon, the owner of WWF. We don't know. China suggests this at a later point. We weren't there, but others...
And we can imagine that China probably pulled some shit on Stephanie McMahon, which would make Vince McMahon be like, we don't necessarily want this girl around.
One
Because I can imagine me
One
doing
hunch.
It.
Yes, we can all imagine. We've all done shit. Like, sometimes you can't control yourself. But other
I mean,
people...
For anyone who wants to know, like, Stephanie went off and had a baby with Triple H. Not one, not two, but three.
Oh, it's so painful. So other people, including China's sister Kathy, have said that she was released from her contract because she wanted $1 million a year, and WWF was like, no.
I mean, all of this feels like it could be real, but the fact is it was a confluence of circumstances.
A confluence of circumstance.
It's a confluence. I've been living in England for quite some time. China herself gave a different account in the months immediately after leaving WWF that diverged from her later claims. She said WWF didn't want to offer enough money, that she thought she deserved more, and that she was frustrated by a lack of development in her character's storyline.
And I think that this is another example of how complex it is to sift through China's history. It also indicates that she at least briefly felt that she was in a situation where she wanted to be paid what she thought she was worth, and the powers that be were like, diva, bye.
They were like, we done.
Onward. So China, after she's terminated from WWF, so remember that like she has fought tooth and nail to forge an identity for herself. It's like the only thing that ever mattered to her. It's her anchor. Her identity was China. And WWF is like, we own the name China. You can't use it anymore. So she starts going by Joni China Doll Lahrer, which is familiar to anyone who dipped their toe into the fetid sea of reality television.
So just so you guys know, in 2007, she would legally change her name to China. But until then, she would have felt totally stripped. She would have been incredibly injured, and it would have ramped up her resentment for the WWF.
So China quickly landed a second Playboy cover and pictorial, an appearance on RIP'd early 2000s gross-out show Fear Factor. Used to watch it. She lost to cultural ghost Coolio. She had bit parts on Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Third Rock from the Sun, and Relic Hunter. She wanted to be an actress.
But wasn't she always kind of playing herself? Like, they weren't giving her really big parts. It was like, hey, it's China.
I mean, no. She would, like, I watched her Sabrina appearance, and she plays, like, a bodybuilding witch. Like, she's in the gym, but she's not China. They're not like, oh, I'm such a big fan of yours, China. What are you doing in the gym? Like, she's got a plot line.
Yeah, she's got a plot line, but she's still having to play someone who's in that space.
Yeah, she's not playing, like, someone's mom.
Yeah, exactly.
So she's bouncing around, and she's working on plotting her next move.
And what will her next move be?
You'll have to wait until part two. You gotta wait till part two.
And Alyssa, do you think you can wait till part two?
Probably not.
No, I don't think I can either. Well,
I don't think so.
I'm Lena Dunham.
And I'm Alyssa.
And we will never call you crazy. Word is a Luminary podcast. It's produced by Pineapple Street Media and Good Thing Going Productions. Our producer is Dina Kleiner, and our associate producers are Sophie Bridges and Zandra Ellen. Jenna Weiss-Berman and Max Linsky are our executive producers. Our theme song is by Liz Fair. Other music is by Matthew McLaughlin and Andrew Miller. Special thanks to Michael Cohen and Victoria Endicott.